Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza on this live broadcast from Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across South Sudan and the rest of Africa this Friday, December 13, 2024. A senior South Sudanese church leader says power is the source of South Sudan's vicious cycle of violence.
Why is power holding the people of South Sudan back? Not like other places, is the real question. It is because the power is only in the hands of the elite in South Sudan.
And we will have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. This weekend marks South Sudan's 11th year of conflict that has devastated the country's population, sending millions to refugee camps in Kenya, Uganda, Democratic Republic of Congo, Sudan, and Ethiopia. The Archbishop of the Internal Province of the Episcopal Church of South Sudan in Western Bahr al-Ghazal State says power is to blame for the 11th years of conflict. Archbishop Moses Deng, who is also the South Sudan Council of Churches Peace Envoy at the Kenyan brokered South Sudan Peace Talks, says the government delegation at the talks has put new demands.
The best way of solving conflict in future so that we don't go back to where we went in 2013 is to have a dialogue. If you remember, during the SPLM convention in Juba, the former Catholic Archbishop of Juba, His Grace Paulino Lugudu, appealed to our political leaders to stop the convention and call for a retreat so that they can dialogue among themselves, especially the top political leadership. That approach that the Archbishop appealed to the leaders, which of course they did not accept, was the best, and it will continue to be the best. Dialogue is the only way forward to avoid the conflict in future in South Sudan
and any other
part of the world.
And you are at Tumaini, where dialogue is one of the rules of the game. How would you assess the progress at these talks in Nairobi? Because people in South Sudan are all paying attention to what will come out of the Tumaini initiative.
Well, there was a very significant progress that was made under the previous government delegation with the opposition and the stakeholders delegation. As you remember, 8 protocols were signed or were initialed on 15th of July, and one protocol was finalized, but it was not initialed at that time because there were a few things that needed to be put together. And we were actually remaining literally with only one in the one protocol, which is known as responsibility sharing. In other places, it's called power sharing. But with the new government delegation now, they suggested that they wanted the previously initial protocols by the previous government delegation to be reviewed because they have some concerns over it. Those ones, the opposition were not comfortable with that, and that's what the mediators and stakeholders have been trying to resolve in the last few days.
I hear you well, and this is the information we are getting from the venue of the talks, that the new government delegation does not have appetite for discussing responsibility sharing. I mean, this is all about people, you know, talking about where they will place themselves. Why is power so important in South Sudan?
Well, power is important not only in South Sudan, but actually all over the world, because power is attached with resources. If you have power, you have resources. That is why when we were in the bush, we were all poor. But when we came, we got independent. Even before we got independent, some people who got into position of power, they are now rich. You will hear them talking of other people who are the poor people, and for them, they are not poor. They are rich because they have power. So it is the reason why power is so important. Why is power holding the people of South Sudan back, not like other places, is the real question. It is because the power is only in the hands of the elite in South Sudan. In other places, especially those that countries that are democratic, the power is in the hand of the people, and the people decide whom to hand it over to, because the power belongs to the people and it is only delegated to the leaders to use it to serve the people. But in South Sudan, it's the other way around. The power actually is in the hand of the elite. And so they fight over it, they quarrel over it, and the people are just helpless because they are suffering down there. Nobody is serving them, while the leaders are struggling over the power. So that is the difference. The power is important everywhere in the world, but the only difference is that the power in South Sudan is not in the hand of the people. It is in the hand of the elite. That is why you see them competing over it.
Archbishop Moses Deng,
okay.
You are the South Sudan Council of Churches envoy at the Tumaini talks. Given this standoff between the government delegation and the other stakeholders, on what are you telling them to do in order to overcome this looming threat to the Tumaini initiative?
The standoff right now is not on the responsibility sharing. It is on the review, the proposed review of the previous initial protocols by the new government delegation. That is what the opposition are objecting to. But they have not moved to the responsibility sharing, because they have not resolved the issue of whether they should review the previous protocols or they should just move to the responsibility sharing. With the government delegation saying, we cannot move to the responsibility sharing protocol unless we have agreed on the issue of the viewing of the previous initial protocols, and the opposition is objecting to that. So that is where they stand up is at the moment.
That's Archbishop Moses Deng, South Sudan Council of Churches Peace Envoy at the Kenyan Brokered Peace Talks, also known as Tumaini Initiative. He spoke to me from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, this past hour. Former President of Ghana John Mahama is returning as Ghana's president-elect after defeating Vice President Mahamudu Bawumia in the December 7th election. His victory comes amid widespread dissatisfaction with the government's management of the country's economic crisis. VOA's Paul Ndiho has more from the Ghanaian capital, Accra.
Ghana has faced severe economic struggles in the past few years, including inflation peaking at 54% in 2022 and easing to 23% by the end of 2023. Voter frustration with the ruling New Patriotic Party is credited with giving former President John Mahama a victory over Vice President Mahamudu Bawumia. Economist Patrick Opoku Assuming says young Ghanaians face a significant job shortage, leading to frustrations that contributed to the government's downfall.
One of the major concerns is their job prospect out of school. So when you ask them, are you looking forward to completing, many of them will say no, because they've seen their colleagues 2, 3, 4 years ahead of them finish and struggle to find jobs. So I think for young people, that's always been a challenge. I mean, having an economy that is growing and creating enough jobs to, you know, for people to earn a basic living, it has been a major, major issue and a major problem.
A key factor in Mahama's win was the youth vote. Young Ghanaians expressed frustration with the unemployment, rising costs, and harsh policies. Kobe Moyes, an influencer and a University of Ghana graduate, notes that young people were angry and hungry, which drove them to vote against the ruling party.
We need the current or the president-elect to work on, one, providing stable jobs, and then to making sure that the economy is well attractive. The economy should be established in such a way that it will be so attractive to us, and then to also attract investors into the country, that we would also get more jobs. They should also establish factories, you know, business centers where we can go and then work.
Israel Otto Arthur, a student at the University of Ghana, says the government's silence on social issues and the previous administration's lack of responsiveness to protests and public outcry contributed to its defeat.
I think as a result of that, they felt we put you in a position to serve us, and we are a democracy as well. But if we voice out our opinions and our opinions aren't heard in that context, I think there should be a change. That was what, from my view, I'm perceiving to be a cause of such action.
Mahama's campaign capitalized on this dissatisfaction by promising a fresh start and focusing on economic recovery. His vision for a 24-hour economy and measures to create jobs resonated with both young and older voters.
He has a whole lot of plans, most especially our 24-hour economy. We are hoping for best, and we know that God being his helper, he implements most policies that will help Ghana and also everyone, every citizen in Ghana. So I'm hoping that Mahama has a lot of vision.
Some political analysts observe that when Mahama takes office, he faces rebuilding an economy weighed down by debt, inflation, and diminished investor confidence. His victory, however, reflects a strong mandate from Ghanaians to tackle these issues. Paul Ndiho, VOA News, Accra, Ghana.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, do you know where your seafood is coming from? Find out more after the break.
Hello, listener of South Sudan in Focus. We have an exciting new segment dubbed Words of Wisdom. We want to hear your thoughtful proverbs that echo through your community. This is another chance for you to share wisdom from your roots. All you need to do is record a proverb in a language of your choice, tell us its English translation and what it means. Keep it brief, authentic, and represent your community. Your recorded proverb shall be sampled on South Sudan in Focus every Wednesday. Send your recording via our WhatsApp number, +1 202 630 8011. That is +1 202 630 8011.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Officials in sub-Saharan Africa, African countries, have agreed it's important to reduce overdependence on imported fish and seafood from North Africa and the European Union, and instead they should strive to cultivate fish farming, which will create jobs for unemployed youth. The officials meeting in Cameroon said their goal is to invest some of what they collectively spent on importing fish each year and put that funding into developing local fish farms. They hope to redirect local fish farmers a large amount of $7 billion spent annually on importing seafood. Moki Edwin Kinzika reports from Cameroon.
Fish farmer Tani Hubert demonstrates how every day he catches and sells at least 10 kilograms of fresh fish from his pond in Corbison, a neighborhood in Cameroon's capital, Yaoundé. He told government officials from 12 African countries who were in Cameroon on Monday that he makes at least $40 each day since he started selling fish 1 year ago from his riverside fish pond in which he farms fish. Hubert said he is one of several hundred youths the government of Cameroon trained and provided financial assistance of about $4,000 each to begin a fish farming business. Etta Collins Ayuk is the director of the Limbe National Institute of Fisheries and Aquaculture created by the government of Cameroon to train fish farmers. He says several hundred unemployed Cameroonians who have received training in fish farming are today supplying fish to local markets and raising enough money to take care of their families.
The catch we get from the wild is rapidly declining, and the only way to ensure fish and fish products availability for local consumption should be through the farming of fish, which is aquaculture.
We train people to get jobs. We don't train people to go and search for employment.
It has said efficient local fish farming will reduce the large amounts of money Cameroon spends each year on importing fish from North Africa and Europe. The government of this Central African country says it has spent about $200 million in 2024 to import 60% of the 550,000 tons of fish and seafood it needs this year to feed its 30 million civilians. Officials and fish farmers from sub-Saharan African countries meeting in Yaoundé on Monday said Africa alone accounts for close to 13% of the world's total fish imports. The continent spends close to $7 billion to import fish and seafood from Europe and North African countries, including Morocco, Egypt, Algeria, and Tunisia, officials said. Oludayo Ganiyu, chief executive officer of Aquapet Ventures, a Nigerian company that promotes local fish farming, says it is unfortunate that despite its huge potential of abundant natural resources, including oceans, rivers, lakes, waterways, and coasts, Africa still spends huge sums of money to import fish.
We import thousands of tons of fish every year that cost us over $1.2 billion. Now the government of my country is encouraging so many people to come into fish farming. The time will come in Nigeria where you not see any imported fish again. Many people are now encouraged to invest more in aquaculture so that this cash dollar used in importation of frozen fish into the country will be channeled into health, education and other infrastructure.
Olodayo said participants at the Yaoundé meeting this week agreed to try to guide their countries to soon invest about 60% of the money they normally use to import fish to instead pursue local fish farming development and production. The plan aims to create jobs for African youths who, due to widespread poverty and joblessness, are leaving their countries to seek work in Europe. The participants said Africa has over 30,000 kilometers of untapped coastline to gradually expand the fishing industry, which has the potential to drive economic growth, ensuring food security and creating jobs. Cameroon's livestock minister, who goes by only one name, Tiger, says the African Continental Free Trade Area, alongside global initiatives, has prepared a blueprint for Africa to use its vast fishing resources to fight hunger and propel development. Tiger says Cameroon and sub-Saharan countries will succeed to stop the importation of fish and seafood from North Africa and Europe, just as they succeeded to stop the importation of frozen chicken and pork from developed countries. He says the United Nations International Fund for Agricultural Development is presently assisting African countries to produce fish locally and reduce dependence on imports. Tiger spoke on Cameroon State TV. He said African nations are fighting to stop illegal fishing on their coastal waters, but did not say how. The United Nations reports that Africa this year accounted for 13.1 billion tons of fisheries and aquaculture production, which is 6% of the world's annual total. At the conference Monday, officials said they hope that by 2026, some 60% of money they use to import fish will be invested in local production. Moki Edwin Kinzeka, VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
From Cameroon, we go to Zimbabwe, where President Emmerson Mnangagwa is urged to sign a bill into law that would abolish death penalty following the bill's landmark passage Thursday by the country's Senate after earlier passage by the lower house of parliament. Columbus Mamvunga has more from Harare.
In an interview with VOA, Zimbabwe's Justice Minister Ziyambe Ziyambe said passage of the death penalty bill is welcomed by President Emmerson Mnangagwa, who since coming to power in 2017 has refused to sign death warrants for those facing capital punishment.
So is a man who has not been an advocate of the death penalty. So the passage of the bill by the Senate towards Christmas is an early Christmas present to him, as he has been an advocate to say we can't do this, and that's the reason why I said he is a man who is going to appreciate the work that has been done by both houses.
Human rights groups are now calling for Mnangagwa to sign the bill, among them Lucia Masuka, the head of Amnesty International in Zimbabwe.
Amnesty International commends the progressive legislative efforts made so far to make the abolition of the death penalty from the country's statutes a reality. We urge the president to take heed of this historic landmark decision by signing this bill without delay and commuting all death sentences to prison terms. The death penalty is the ultimate cruel, inhuman and degrading punishment and has no place in our world.
In the past, Mnangagwa has refused to sign some bills after Parliament had passed them. But Ziyambe says that will not happen this time.
Oh, they say it's an early Christmas present if he does not want to sign it. He's lived the pain and trauma of being on death row and he was saved by a technicality. He's ready to sign like yesterday.
But not everyone is happy with this latest development. One of them is Zakaria Choga, an attorney in Harare.
I still believe adequate research was not properly done on this regard. If you look at the increase in crime in Zimbabwe at the moment, especially violent crimes, robberies, armed robberies to be specific, house break-ins, it's only going to escalate further with the death penalty off the table, because it appeared with the death penalty on the table, it could have been the only deterrent that we had at this particular point. But now with the death penalty gone, we're going to see a rise in violent crimes of that nature.
According to Amnesty International, 24 countries across sub-Saharan Africa have abolished the death penalty for all crimes, while two additional countries have abolished it for ordinary crimes only. Zimbabwe's last known execution was in 2005, though courts continue to impose death sentences for cases of murder committed under aggravating circumstances. In April, all those condemned to death had their sentences commuted to life in prison by President Mnangagwa. Columbus Mavunga, VOA News, Harare, Zimbabwe.
From Zimbabwe, we come back to the United States. He may be better known to the world as the father of Tesla and SpaceX, but in a few months, Elon Musk is expected to take an aim at U.S. government spending. VOA's senior Washington correspondent Carolyn Presitti explains what skills Musk brings to the advisory committee known as DOJ.
Elon Musk, known as the brains behind SpaceX and Tesla, is taking over with an axe to government spending in a newly created Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE. which is also the name of a cryptocurrency inspired by a dog meme.
We're going to get the government off your back and out of your pocketbook.
Doge plans to cut $2 trillion, about a third of the government budget, and three-fourths of government workers.
The future is going to be amazing!
Musk, like Donald Trump when he first ran for president, has no government experience. But his companies, SpaceX and Tesla, have proven efficient, especially with the streamlining of the Tesla assembly line. During the COVID-19 pandemic, Musk moved his Tesla headquarters from California to Texas, blaming excessive state regulations and high costs. He and his Doge co-chair, fellow billionaire entrepreneur Vivek Ramaswamy, are expected to mirror that process and eliminate many federal regulations. To reduce costs, Doge will suggest closing some agencies and take steps to prompt mass resignations of federal workers by ending popular telework programs and moving some offices out of Washington. Steve Lankert leads the union representing government workers.
It's going to be a hard learning curve for him to understand that, a president isn't a king, or at least it's not supposed to be in this country, and that you're going to run against constitutional issues, you're going to run up against the law, you're going to run up against mandates of Congress.
To that end, Musk and Ramaswamy last week visited Capitol Hill. Many lawmakers support Doge's stated goal of trimming government spending, but would likely resist cuts that impact their constituents. Others know the men have a direct line to the president-elect. Musk and his mother celebrated Thanksgiving with Donald Trump at Mar-a-Lago, while Ramaswamy posted to Instagram his Thanksgiving beach reading on how to reduce the budget.
And I don't know if you've gotten to know Elon yet, but he doesn't bring a chisel. He brings a chainsaw, and we're going to be taking it to that bureaucracy.
Doge was created as an outside advisory panel that will recommend cuts to the Trump administration and to Congress, which would have final authority over any decisions. Neither Musk nor Ramaswamy will take a government salary. Carolyn Presutti, VOA News.
That's all we prepared for you this Friday, December 13, 2024. We now leave you with Radio and Wizard featuring B2C and the song Gotamiza.
Angel,
you're so tempting. But even closer, come like a smile on my face. Look at the walk away from the rest. Sing up and dig it up formula. Then send me a computer. One up on your binocular.
We have been listening to Radio and Whistle featuring B2C and the song Gotamiza. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Studio 14 here in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and engineer, Patrick Dare, we wish you a lovely evening. Remember to join us next week for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Mutima kwensigaza yumewana ndoto.